Never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation on this episode of Bergen Banter. Hi, everyone. I am Dr. Larry Levanka, and I am the host of Bergen Banter, the college's official podcast in its season-closing episode, Part 2. So if you listen to Part 1, we discussed the concept of de-extinction with Professor John Smalley. We talked about how de-extinction is essentially a way of engineering, creating life, and it's being done in different species of animals and how that science actually works. Professor Smalley did a great job, but now we turn our attention to Part 2 of our season-closing episode, to talk about the ethics of that work and what are some of the considerations of performing such scientific endeavor. So today we have Professor Kevin Olbris from the Philosophy and Religion Department here at the college to discuss some of those ethical considerations about the work that Colossal and others are doing. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here talking about this today. Appreciate it.
All right. So let's get into it then. So let's start with, when you talk about science and ethics, there's always going to be this sort of crossover, this interplay between the two disciplines. How does one evaluate what's happening in science from an ethical or moral compass or lens? Talk about that first.
Well, that's a great question. And I think that when we think about science, one of the things that we have to remember is that in most fundamental respects, it's like any other human endeavor. And so it has to be guided by moral and ethical considerations. So I think one of the first things that we do when we think about science and ethics is remind ourselves that there's a special kind of pull towards the wonder of science and to the incredible things that we can learn, we can discover, we can know, and that we can do when we engage in scientific endeavors. But on the other hand, it also has to be guided by ethics. And a great place to start are some of the historical moments when science was not guided by ethics. And so we can call to mind instances like for instance, forced sterilization in America, the idea that understanding how genes work and then the minute we start to apply that to social problems, the possibility happens that we might perform some kind of eugenics functions and change the gene pool in the attempt, of course, to make things better.
But in one person or one group's eyes, right? To engineer, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so I think that if we remember, so these two important aspects, first, that we remember that science is a human endeavor and should be guided by ethics. And secondly, that there are these historical moments that we should remember and call to mind when we've failed to think ethically about what science is doing. So I think that that's a great starting point for thinking about science. The next and most important part, though, is that as this is the second part in the podcast, the first part was about the science of it. That requires expertise. That requires people who understand some of the minutiae and the detail of science in ways that the non-expert doesn't. So we also want to make sure that the people who are involved in ethical decision-making are informed by the science or perhaps even scientists themselves.
So to understand consequence, I mean, is that the driver behind saying that you would hope that the scientists are not only versed in the science, but versed in the topic as a whole or the concept as a whole?
Yes, I think that that's right. Yeah, I think it's right. And that's in part because we want to understand the consequences of what we do, which can sometimes be incredibly complicated.
Sure.
And when we think about our topic, when we think about de-extinction, now we've got an incredibly complicated topic. We're talking about ecosystems. We're talking about species and how we define a species and how everything is biologically related. And those consequences can be very far-reaching.
And consequence doesn't necessarily have to be a negative. It is just the end result of whatever the initial action was, right?
Absolutely.
And I think we'll get into that a little bit more later, how there are potential benefits to this kind of work. And
absolutely,
there's benefits that we've already seen. But I think from a core or foundational perspective when it comes to ethics. Colossal. I mean, are they engineering life? Are they creating life? I'm sure philosophers and those who study religion would have an opinion on that. Is that what Colossal is doing? Are they creating life?
Another really great question. Are they creating life? And I know that from the biological standpoint, there's a question of whether or not they're really resurrecting an extinct species.
Or just plugging the gaps, as Professor Smalley said in our last episode.
Yes.
They're not taking a carbon copy necessarily, but they're taking elements, which to me would sound more like a hybrid species or a hybrid copy rather than a direct, again, carbon copy of a species or a person for that matter. But so creating life, whether it's a hybrid or whether it's an exact replica, is that what's going on here?
It could be. And I think that if we were to think about it from a philosophical perspective, I would want to bring up what ethicists sometimes call a natural law ethics. A natural law ethics takes into account some fundamental human goods that are kind of written into nature. So generally, nature itself and the natural world and life are considered to be intrinsic goods. They're goods that are things that are considered to be morally good and morally valuable, independent of necessarily their relationship with other things. So human life, the ability for humans to procreate, human knowledge and sociability, all of those things are considered to be a kind of fundamental good in natural law ethics. But natural law ethics is also underpinned by some understanding of the way that the world works and the way that reality works. It's generally considered, but doesn't have to be, a religious point of view. And on this point of view, the world has within it what we might call natural kinds. There are certain kinds of things which have a purpose and which have a place in nature. And so from this particular metaphysical and ethical perspective, you might say that the creation of a species which serves as a proxy for an extinct species that doesn't exist anymore maybe is very close in kind to it. That might be the creation of a distinct and unique type, a distinct natural kind, which is something fundamentally different from what we've ever seen before. The natural kinds that exist in nature, from various species of crabs to different oak trees, they all have their particular distinct type as a result of a natural process, which seems to be unfolding, if you're a religious person, according to a plan, or if you're not a religious person, according to the way that nature operates. But this new species, this sort of resurrected direwolf or something like it, is completely different from anything that has come before.
And thus unnatural? And the impact of an unnatural species or an unnatural anything on the world would have consequence, right?
Could potentially have consequences, yes. And I think in the case of something like the direwolf, this company has crafted these three animals, and they are very unique, but they're also functionally and structurally so similar to a gray wolf that they probably would fit into the environment in a similar way. But for all we know, even small differences could make for big changes in an environment. And we know that they're larger. We know that they have a particular color. That could be an advantage or a disadvantage, depending on the environment. And so you don't know the consequences of the release of that kind of animal. And speaking of consequences, from a utilitarian ethical standpoint, if that particular animal is released into the wild and causes changes that are bad for the rest of the ecosystem, we have actually created a form of life which has a fundamentally negative impact. You also might worry from that utilitarian perspective about the consequences on that animal. There are only three. Mm-hmm. And are they, like other wolves, inherently social creatures? Do they have enough sociability for they themselves to live lives that don't contain a lot of suffering? So from a utilitarian standpoint, we would think not only about the consequences for the environment and for us, but also the consequences for those animals themselves and how and their well-being.
I suppose the behavior or the perspective that we're taking on dire wolves is one thing, yes. but it's not just about dire wolves. There are right. other species that are being discussed. And just in my view, I think it's inevitable that we start to talk about humans, right? And
yes.
and human life. I think that's just, I think the natural progression, if it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, it starts with the dire wolf, but it sort of progresses to there, or maybe even the dinosaurs, right? And all
right.
these different species.
Right.
So the ethical considerations of those individual species are individualized. We can talk about the dire wolves being, reintroduced into an environment, but how can one rationalize or view the impacts of all of these individual species on their own ecosystems and environments?
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that would probably drive me nuts as an ethicist.
Yes, yes. Fortunately, though, I think that we have more tools than just consequences. We do actually have a number of different ethical frameworks from which to consider these questions. It is definitely true that if you're thinking about ethics from a particular framework, from a utilitarian framework, and you're asking yourself, like, what are the consequences going to be of this kind of activity? And the complexity of figuring out those consequences can sometimes be such that we might say to ourselves, maybe that particular ethical framework is not the right one. Maybe we are not capable of determining the consequences in the way that we need to apply it.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so if we're applying that natural law ethics as a framework instead, we might be able to answer the question in different ways. We might ask ourselves, are we, fundamentally engaging in behavior here, human behavior that will result in suffering or that will result in deformed forms of life or damage to things that exist right now or prevent existing conservation. So if we start to approach it from those kinds of points of view, we get different sorts of answers. And we might also ask ourselves what we're doing here from what we sometimes call a virtue ethics perspective. This is a point of view that says that when we evaluate or determine the rightness or wrongness of an action, we have to ask ourselves carefully about our own motivations and whether or not these are the kinds of things that a virtuous or good person would do. Mm-hmm. So there are some concerns that we might have in this case, but we also, and I don't want to approach this dogmatically. I kind of like thinking about this. It's fairly new. Mm-hmm. From multiple perspectives and thinking about what those different perspectives entail. So if we approach this from a virtue ethics standpoint, what we see is the company creating, for instance, the dire wolf and with the plan of maybe creating other animals probably also has a profit motive.
Of course.
And, that's probably somewhere in their minds. They have shareholders and they have investors.
Yes.
And are they doing it out of a sense of sort of awe for nature? Or are they doing it out of a sense of, look what we can do, look what we're capable of? And sometimes look what we're capable of produces some of the worst possible results. Mm-hmm. Now, before I say that a virtue ethicist would have to condemn all de-extinction, it's important to recognize that a virtue ethicist or any other ethical framework might instead put guide rails on the work and say that there are some things that we have to make sure that we're doing in an ethical way in order to proceed. And I feel fairly certain that the company Colossal has done some of that kind of stuff, although I would imagine they also are concerned for the other things.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. So would an example then be putting a guardrail to say, look, we're going to do this work
right.
for the wow factor and to prove that we can
yeah.
and to make our company valuation higher and to make our shareholders money and
right.
all of those things.
Right.
But we're not going to release these animals into the wild. We're
right.
not going to
right.
use this technology to upset the ecosystem. And we are going to create colossal zoo that has all of these hybrid species
yeah.
in it.
Yeah.
Opening a zoo of mutants has
yeah.
its own sort of perspective
yeah.
associated with it. But
it does.
Talk about examples like that
yeah.
as guardrails and
yeah.
how do you approach something like that where you're not going to maybe disrupt, but you're still going to do it anyway.
Right. Yes. The idea of zoos is, of course, fraught with any of the issues that zoos confront.
Yes.
Are the animals living the lives that they should be living? That they, from a natural law perspective, that they're designed to live? Or are they living even a life from a utilitarian perspective that is comfortable and flourishing is the word that they might usually use. So, I mean, are we looking at lives that have well-being?
Yes.
And you can probably have some degree of that in a zoo or in that kind of setting. So creating that kind of thing, I think we do have some, you know, we have a kind of example. And it, I think this point underscores the fact that de-extinction, while relatively new, is really very similar to other kinds of human experiences we've already had. We already know about the ethics of zoos. We already have, we understand the concerns of, say, dolphins that are kept in captivity and whales and things like that. But it might also be connected, you know, you mentioned zoos and that's important, but there are also natural environments that I think people would like to reintroduce animals that have recently gone extinct from.
Yes.
And for that, we have the so-called Tasmanian tiger, mm-hmm. animals like that, where people think, you know, we got rid of them because we wanted to farm animals. Mm-hmm. It was within the past 150 years. It's a shame that they're gone. We have the DNA. Maybe we can bring those animals back and reintroduce them. And that takes a perspective, an ethical perspective, that says that human beings have done a kind of harm to the natural world. Mm-hmm. We've had an impact on it in a very negative way. Maybe we, as a matter of restorative justice, should return these species to the natural world. So not only, you know, do we have examples and can think about this in terms of zoos and in terms of creating specific little ecosystems where animals that we've recreated can thrive, but we can also think about it in terms of a different goal of restorative justice and returning the natural world to a state that it maybe it ought to be were it not for human intervention.
I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
I want to clip it. Something you said, though, made me chuckle before. Does an unnatural species have rights as a natural species or animal?
Yeah, it's a great question. The question of the moral status of animals is an incredibly interesting one. Mm-hmm. And when we apply a certain amount of philosophical rigor to the topic, we usually means that we have to start thinking about animals somewhat like we think about people. So perhaps an animal has certain kinds of rights because they live a certain form of life. There will be some rights that, of course, they just can't have. We can't suggest that my dog has a right to vote. Does my dog have a right?
Sometimes it appears as if dogs are voting, though.
They are. Who is in charge sometimes? The dogs and cats are us. But on the other hand, they are capable of suffering and they are capable of flourishing and there is healthcare available to them. And so would we say then that because of that, an animal might have a right to a certain degree of healthcare or food or shelter, especially in the case of domesticated animals whose lives are lived in such a way that we made them that way?
Yes.
But I think of the standard poodle. I owned a standard poodle for 15 years. Wonderful dog. They have hair and not fur. They have to be shaved and they have to be clipped regularly and be maintained in a certain way. There's not an animal that can live in the wild anymore. Its wild days are long gone. Yeah. And so, you know, we might say to ourselves, we did that. You know, we did that to this animal. And so we have a responsibility to take care of it.
And the question then becomes about colossal and de-extinction work. Yeah. Well, how is it any different from engineering the standard poodle or engineering a specific kind of apple that tastes better and has a longer shelf life, right?
Yes.
I suppose there's a perspective that would say all of those things as well, right?
Absolutely, yes. This is another example of how even though the technology is distinctly new and opens up new possibilities, is also something relatively familiar. We would, again, be making a species. We've done it. Our bananas don't look anything like wild bananas, right?
That's right.
They're much fleshier. They're far less seedy. And we have always been changing the environment and altering the animals that are around us. And so in some ways, this is just a special case of that.
But does that make it okay. I mean, right. I mean, that Pandora's box was opened, I mean, hundreds of years ago when you start talking about engineering of different species of, of agriculture and so on. So does this make de-extinction just the next evolutionary step in what amounts to hundreds of years of scientific progress?
It's a good question. And you know, a lot of it hinges on what we think of as natural versus unnatural. Mm. It's not an easy question to answer, what's unnatural versus what isn't. And it's also not clear that things, in virtue of their being not natural or not resulting because of natural versus human processes, that they shouldn't have a kind of moral status. I mean, much around us right now is unnatural, from our glasses to these microphones, right? It's so much that is unnatural, on some sense of the word unnatural. So creating new species which aren't the result of evolutionary processes that took place over thousands of years, or attempting to resurrect in some way an extinct species, doesn't, I think, remove the species from what it is fundamentally, in the sense of a creature that could be capable of suffering and flourishing and might have to be treated in a particular way as a result of that. And that's a kind of a long-winded way of saying that we probably have duties to the things that we make, to the things that are our responsibility. We might have some kind of responsibility, if we can, to bring back the Tasmanian tiger, if it can be reintroduced in the environment in a way that's in any way similar to how it was before, which is an open question. So I think that we do have, you know, I've attempted not to be dogmatic, but I think from a philosophical standpoint, we do have a kind of responsibility for things that, a moral responsibility for the things that we took a hand in making. And that might be true for restorative justice and bringing back a species which has gone extinct, but performs a critical role in an environment. De-extinction might help with that kind of thing. But back to consequences. That's a perilous thing. We have attempted, human beings have attempted to reintroduce species, I think of the cane frog in Australia, in an attempt to correct for another invasive species or another environmental issue, and it turned out to be an absolute disaster. So again, those consequences. We might do things because we feel like we have a duty of restorative justice, a duty of responsibility, and only to discover that the consequences are much different than we had thought that they would be.
So, you know, I asked Professor Smalley the same question.
Yeah.
And I will pose it to you as well.
Okay.
Net positive or net negative, this kind of work, with everything that we've talked about today and discussed, how this work in some way, shape, or form has been going on forever and ever.
Yeah.
Is it a benefit to society? Is it a negative to society? Or does it really depend on the lens that you're using to evaluate it?
I think to be slightly more dogmatic and offer an actual opinion rather than just possible points of view, I think that I would say that it is likely to be a net positive, as provided that it operates under those ethical guardrails, the guidance that you might need to prevent serious harm. One of the reasons that I think that it could be a net positive is that this is a kind of biomedical technology. Mm-hmm. The more work that we do with biomedical technology, the more that we learn about biology, about cells, about reproduction, about genetics. And there's so much to learn in that field that requires us to do probably some degree of tinkering.
And who knows what that unlocks for all of us, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, if we think about that, just in case of the direwolves, I believe that they created over 300 possible and implantable cells.
Correct.
There was 40-some that were actually attempted to be implanted in dogs.
Viable
in some way. And of that, they have three. And that those numbers on their own are, you know, kind of staggering. Out of the over 300, we get three. So we're already looking at a very, you know, low percentage chance of success with this kind of thing because of its complexity. So all the more reason to have those guardrails in place. But I think also the successes are all the more reason why we should continue, because of the possibility of tremendous benefit, not only for humans, but also for the natural world in general.
I think that's fair. Yeah. I think that's fair. Professor Kevin Olbrus is our guest today, who is closing season one of Bergen Banter. And this has been a discussion on de-extinction that has now gone through the gamut. We've gone through biology and technology, now into ethics and morality. And I've really enjoyed it. So thanks for coming on the show today, Professor.
Thanks for having me. It's been terrific.
And that is a close of season one. I can't believe that we've already gone through an entire season of the official Bergen Community College podcast. So, as your host, we will see you once again in September, as the song goes. Never mind the noise and the chatter. We are here for intelligent, fact-based conversation on Bergen Banter, and we will see you again down the road.